This week, the hotel at Oberlin hosted a conference titled The State of American Democracy, A National Conversation, which brought an array of notable writers, journalists, academics, and policy experts to Oberlin. The event is the first in a series meant to be, as its website states, a nonpartisan, thoughtful, and rigorous series of discussions that examines the origins of our present situation and considers how to rebuild the resilience and durability of our democratic institutions. You're listening to The Weekly, a co-production of WOBC and The Oberlin Review. I'm your host, Johan Cabert, and I'm joined by my co-host and the managing editor of The Oberlin Review, Daniel Marcus.
Thanks for having me.
Of course. We're extremely honored to be talking with Stephen Kinzer, a senior fellow at the Watson Institute for International and Public Affairs at Brown University. In addition, Professor Kinzer is an award-winning foreign correspondent called Among the Best in Popular Foreign Policy Storytelling by the Washington Post. He's covered more than 50 countries and spent more than 20 years working for the New York Times. He is the author of numerous books and is a current columnist for the Boston Globe. Last but not least, Professor Kinzer was one of the headline speakers at this week's State of American Democracy Conference. We are so pleased to have you. Welcome to The Weekly.
Great to be here for my first visit to Oberlin.
Yeah. Just to start off, you just finished attending Oberlin's State of American Democracy Conference. We were wondering what the goal of the conference was, and sort of its stated theme is clearly democracy, but that seems pretty broad.
This is a very interesting concept put together by people who are trying to figure out what to do with this widespread but pretty diffuse unhappiness and frustration at what's going on in America and what America is doing in the world. So it brought together people who were covering all sorts of different areas from social media to voter suppression to, in my case, world affairs and foreign policy. And the theme was to try to figure out where we go from here. How do we try to build some kind of a movement or a counter concept and take this kind of diffuse unhappiness and congeal it into something that can be positive? So not just complaining, part of the theme of the conference was don't tell us what's wrong, because we hear that all the time, but where do we go from here? And I think that's a very positive thing. Actually, the Oberlin version of this conference, just the beginning. They're going to Denver next, and they're having several others. So they're hoping that this will be a way to bring people together from various parts of the political spectrum who are unhappy with what is a very clear phenomenon in American life, and that is the decline of true democracy in our country. Now, I'm not going to tell you how old I am, but I can tell you that in my short lifetime, I have truly seen America become a less democratic country. This is not the direction we were supposed to go in. And we're trying to figure out, so how do we try to turn that around? How do we try to rescue the democracy that our founders envisioned? And I think that's probably at the root of the conference idea.
So one of the things that I'm interested in is, you know, we talk about like rebuilding foundational institutions of our democracy. That's a pretty big thing to try to endeavor to accomplish, and especially, you know, things like constitutional reform or major sort of structural alterations to capitalist systems. Those are things that seem largely unattainable in the political climate. Is there anything that can be done that is sort of more feasible in the current political climate or even past political climates that were less polarized?
Well, if you're talking about domestic politics, I think one thing that we really can focus on and might be able to accomplish is to try to confront the problem of gerrymandering and voter suppression, which has produced these bizarre results in many states where the Democrats get, in the case of Wisconsin as an example, 2 million more votes statewide, but the legislature is overwhelmingly Republican. Why is that? It's right. Because the districts have been drawn in these very odd ways. And the technology by which people are drawing these districts is amazing. The amount of social media that's been fed into there, all voting patterns, all histories of all people living on every block. And so they can tell you, if we move the district lines one block over, what's that going to mean for the population of the district? It's gotten so sophisticated that it really is infringing on people's rights to represent themselves. And you've got this other piece, which is voter suppression. All these laws trying to make sure people can't register, people can't vote. You want to diminish the number of people that have access to the ballot. So I think that this is an issue that can unite people from across the spectrum. Mm-hmm. If people show up and they think they're registered to vote and they say, oh, we purged your name from the list, or you don't have a gun permit, so your student ID isn't good enough, but if you had a gun permit, you could vote. We got to get rid of those kind of things. At least this would give people a chance to be heard. Now, what they would be saying when they're heard, that's the next step.
Right.
How do you shape people's perceptions in ways that they understand what's good for them and what's bad for them in politics? That's a huge challenge. But before we even get there, mm-hmm. we have to have a system where everybody's at least allowed to participate. And if you don't have that, what happened to the democracy that we were promised?
Yeah. Do you think that that's something that probably ends up happening legislatively or more through the district and federal court system?
I think both. However, you may know that there was a Supreme Court decision essentially gutting the Voting Rights mm-hmm. Act. There was a provision in the Voting Rights Act that said that states with a long history of voter suppression had to check with the federal government before they changed their voting laws. Mm-hmm. And that clause has now been struck down right. by the new Supreme Court. Mm-hmm. So that is going to make court challenges more difficult, and mm-hmm. certainly it frees these states to go back to the days of Jim Crow. On the other hand, I do think that Democrats in this case will be taking a leaf from the Republican book and realizing they've got to concentrate on state legislature elections, because it's the state legislatures usually that draw the lines for mm-hmm. congressional districts. Mm-hmm. So national parties have never really been focused on state legislative elections, but the Republicans figured out that with a very small amount of money, you can flip a lot of states. Mm-hmm. And I think there's now an effort in the Democratic Party to realize that we should be trying to fight back and try to see if we can't use some of these tactics as well to make sure that when the next redistricting comes, which is soon, it comes in the years that end with zero because of the census years, that at least there's some balance and at least people from both parties are in the room right. when the districts are drawn instead of only one party in the room, which is what's happening now in many states.
Mm-hmm. I read sort of that with the recent Virginia election, even though the Democrats sort of won overwhelmingly, they still didn't even sort of take the majority. And that, you know, really speaks to gerrymandering.
You're absolutely correct. The Virginia case is a great example. The number of people voting Democratic was substantially higher than the number of people voting Republican, but the chambers still become Republican. And that's because of clever gerrymandering. So manipulating the political system is a way to make sure that only certain opinions get heard. And that's a way to close democracy. And this is a very troubling trend in the United States.
Do the results in Virginia give you any sense of optimism? Because I think that one of the sort of primary explanations that's been given for the rise of Donald Trump is a rejection of the establishment. And in Virginia, you know, you had a lot of fairly establishment candidates, granted on a much smaller scale with much smaller press and name recognition, but doing fairly well and winning seats. Does that sort of make you optimistic at all?
One thing I share with Donald Trump is my desire to get rid of the establishment. I don't like them either.
Okay.
And I agree with him that the political elite is totally out of touch with the masses of voters, just very self-involved in this Washington echo chamber. Fact that we're now saying, oh, good, finally people are going back to the establishment, and we think this is positive, shows you how far down we've come. Mm-hmm. So it's nice to know that we're coming out of the sewer back to the establishment, but that's where we've been all these years. The next step is to try to break away from that and provide an alternative to traditional politics that's not the alternative we're being given now, mm-hmm. but that is not a return to the liberal, conservative, democratic, republican coalition that essentially agrees on everything.
Mm-hmm. Do you think the conference was successful in sort of bringing that new narrative? Sort of from the guest list, it seems like there's a lot of sort of, long-term... Well, established and respected sort of Washington insiders. I mean, how do we open up the room and sort of make it so that more people, the people whose voices haven't been heard, are sort of key to this rebuilding democracy?
This was not a conference made up of all bomb throwers.
Yeah.
There were a few of us, but there was an effort, I think, to try to bring in people who are in the mainstream of American politics. And the person with whom I shared my panel on world affairs was one of those people. I think that's quite reasonable. I don't think we had many people who were trying to say that what's happening now is good or trying to defend the status quo. But, you know, it goes back to the last question you asked. There were some people there who say, we've gone too far from what America was 10 years ago or 5 years ago, what we were used to. We got to get back to that. Then there were people like me who were thinking, you know, where we were 5 or 10 years ago actually wasn't good either. And we don't want to go back there. We want to find some kind of a new paradigm.
Mm-hmm. To follow up on that, are there ways that journalists can sort of specifically work to get those voices better represented?
Well, you're touching on one of my real bugaboos now. So I go to Washington as infrequently as possible, but once in a while I have to go there. And it never ceases to impress me how united all the main groups in Washington are around central principles. They all agree with just a little bit of argument on some very pernicious ideas, and this is most visible in world affairs. So you have, as I said, there's almost all liberals, almost all conservatives in Washington, almost all Democrats, almost all Republicans, almost every think tank is caught up in the idea of American exceptionalism. Mm-hmm. We know better what's good for the world than the world itself knows. What was it Madeleine Albright said? We are the indispensable nation. We stand taller and see farther than the others. You have to believe that our country knows how to guide problems all over the world, that if there's ever a crisis anywhere in the world, the United States has to jump in. Everybody's just waiting for this because we have the answer to pacify everything. Now, I just listed all the groups in Washington that are part of this echo chamber. If you don't buy into these assumptions, you just can't have lunch in Washington. You're thought of as some kind of wacko. But what really irritates me as a person who spent his life as a journalist is that the press has joined into this echo chamber. Mm. I can't even read my old newspaper anymore. Sometimes I think if it's not an article on the front page about how Putin is a thug and a murderer, then it's going to be something about how Iran is coming to attack us. It's just a constant reverberation of this beating the drums for war, conflict, intervention. So to me, the press is supposed to be the one institution that stands apart. From my perspective as a reporter, whenever everybody agrees on something, that's the time the press has to step in and say, whoa, I'm going to look under the carpet and see if there's something under here. And to see the press abandoning that role and largely falling in the line of march with all the other political elites is something I find most lamentable. So, yes, journalists can definitely play a role, and the role they have to play is to be outsiders. You know, they like to tell you that essentially America is a team. Like a sports team. Everybody has their role. And the president is leading the team, and then there's the Congress and various other institutions, and the press has its role to play on the team. But I don't agree with this. The press is not supposed to be on anybody's team. We're supposed to be above it, beyond it, outside it. And the specter of seeing the press pulled into this mindless consensus that dominates Washington is, to me, personally, because of my background, the most distressing aspect of it.
I want to follow up on that because I think one thing that was talked about a lot during the 2016 election cycle, when we were seeing a lot of, I think, what you're talking about, the press on either side of the political spectrum sort of shifting towards its respective party, you know, Fox News shifting even farther towards the Republican Party's sort of line, and press institutions like the New York Times falling in line more or less with the Democratic Party talking points. Do you think that the press should be, as some people have argued, dead center, completely nonpartisan? Or do you think that the press should be almost radically partisan in the sense that wherever there is, you know, that granule of truth, no matter where it falls on the political spectrum, that's where they should go?
The second one.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't believe that the press should fall in line. I don't believe that the press has to be completely mindless and not aware. You know, I used to have trouble with this concept of objectivity. So am I supposed to be objective between the truth and the lie? Am I supposed to treat the torturer the same way that I treat the torture victim? Is that objectivity? I didn't become a journalist to become objective in that way. So I try to guide myself by another word rather than objectivity, and that is fairness. Try to be fair. But that allows you to make your own judgments about what really is fair out there. And I think that's something journalists can do. So journalists should not try to kind of split the loaf right in the middle and make sure you're doing half on one side and half on the other. On the contrary, rather than seek to please everybody as much as possible, the press succeeds when it angers the most people most frequently. So you want to have a variety of critics if you're a journalist. I think that's the great sign for a great reporter or a great periodical. Not so much that it has the perfect array of friends, but it has the perfect array of critics.
Right. Mm-hmm. So then one thing that I think a lot of people, and perhaps even myself, would argue is that in a lot of cases, especially during the 2016 cycle, the so-called place of being fair oftentimes did fall along party lines in a lot of ways. So how do you know, because there's a real tension there of like when that fairness is with one party or the other party versus when it's not. How do you balance that?
You're never supposed to think, wait a minute now, this story that I'm thinking about writing, which side would that benefit? You know, I don't want to write this story because actually it's going to hurt the people that I support. That's death for a journalist. Right. So I don't like the idea of news outlets tilting towards candidates. I like the idea of news outlets holding all candidates accountable. People should be scared when reporters walk into the room. Mm-hmm. Even I remember when I was in high school, I was working for my high school newspaper. And sometimes I'd walk into the room where my friends were hanging around in the basement doing whatever kids did in the basement in the 60s. And somebody would look up and say, uh-oh, the press is here. That was a joke, but I like it. Yeah, and I think the idea that the generals, the senators, the think tank people are so happy to welcome their brothers and sisters of the press to sit around the table and join them is uncomfortable. I don't like that. I don't think we should be striving to be welcome at the table of power. We should be pariahs at the table of power.
I think a lot of this sort of speaks to the movement that you see of the politicization of the press and sort of the ideological movement sort of being infused with the press. And that also is sort of, it's a more recent development that the press is breaking down and sort of splintering into these ideological groups. What do you think the forces that led to that are, and sort of how can we work to undo that? Is there a way to make the press more, as you said, fair?
The press is subject to many of the same pressures of other institutions in America. We are trying to tell ourselves good things about us. We want to know what's good about us. We want to hear how great we are. And relentlessly focusing on inequality, Black Lives Matter, the Occupy movement, seems to be a little bit of a fringe. So let's just have one story of that, and then we get back to the main story about what the senator said at a press conference today. That's the kind of pressure that the press has to resist. I don't like the agenda-setting power that people in Washington have. So my observation is that actually the establishment of power cannot tell reporters what to write. It doesn't dictate what we write, but it does dictate to a large extent what we write about. What are the most important questions facing America? Well, let's see what the senators are talking about. Let's see what's being debated in Congress. What did the president mention in his last two press conferences? Those are the most important things in America. I hate that idea. When George W. Bush was president, there was almost no coverage of the climate change issue for 8 years. The reason? Well, the president never mentions it. It's not being debated in Congress, so I guess it's not an issue. I don't like the press swallowing the agenda of power. Mm-hmm. So that's the great influence that power has over the press. Not to tell us what to write, but by setting the themes that we write about, effectively, they are telling us what to write.
Mm-hmm. Sort of building off that, do you think, it seems to me that Donald Trump's election, much like sort of the splintering of the press that has been sort of happening over time, was not a one-off event that came very suddenly and unexpectedly. Do you think that election had been stewing for a long time and sort of finally exploded? And that being the case, perhaps, are there any sort of key historic moments that you think opened that door to being a possibility?
I do think that this was something that was gestating for quite some time. I don't think, certainly in my lifetime, there's ever been a major party candidate for president who was worse suited to the moment than Hillary Clinton. Mm-hmm. She was the exact opposite of what everybody wanted. And it shows the corruption of the Democratic Party that would be the person who would be provided as the alternative to Donald Trump. So I think that we need to pull back from the idea of thinking that our options are the options that the two political parties are presenting us with. Let's be more creative and try to open up the argument. You know, journalists have such an ability to go to places that people haven't thought about before, to present stories in different ways. So much of journalism is just repetition from the echo chamber. Let me give you an example of how powerful this force can be, because I've lived through this as a reporter many years. So I was living in Nicaragua in the 1980s. During that time, the leftist pro-Castro Sandinista government was in power, and Ronald Reagan was waging a war against them. One of the tropes that was being used in Washington all the time was that the Soviet Union was going to send MiG fighter jets to be based in Nicaragua, and then the United States would be under imminent threat. So this was a story that we always had to keep in the backs of our minds. I never saw any evidence of it, but it was talked about in Washington, so we had to be aware of it. So one evening, I get a very excited phone call from the New York Times in New York, and they're saying, "Oh my God, Washington's going nuts. The MiGs, they're coming to Nicaragua. This is huge. You've got to get on the story." So I said, "Whoa, let me tell you something. This is a small town down here. I know what's going on here. If they are going to bring the MiGs in, they're going to have to be certain preparations, which I've already thought through because I know there's a story. Nothing has been done. Let me tell you something. There's no MiGs coming into Nicaragua, I guarantee you." And the guy said to me, "You don't understand. The Secretary of Defense is saying this. We've got the CIA calling us. Washington is on high alert. You got to do something. You got to get up tomorrow morning and you got to go out to the port and you got to do a story." I said, okay, I'm going to go. So I got in my car. I drove up to Corinto, very sleepy, like any other day. They have not reinforced the rickety wooden bridges, which would be required in order to carry heavy cargo across. Sure enough, there is a Russian freighter out there, but nothing's happening. They're unloading some optical equipment and everything. There's no security, no police, no army. So nothing's happening. I write my story. And then it comes out, and the story is Soviet MiGs not coming to Nicaragua. So I feel great. I feel, whoa, I ripped away the veil of lies and I showed that there's no Russian MiGs coming to Nicaragua. That's the headline, Russian MiGs not coming to Nicaragua. Later on, I began to realize, wait a minute, I think I fell into the trap, because the headline, no Soviet MiGs coming to Nicaragua, pretty much fades in people's minds, and the headline means Sandinistas, MiGs, Soviet, Nicaragua, something. I forgot, I didn't remember all the details, but I helped connect in the minds of New York Times readers, mm-hmm. Soviet MiG fighter jets with Sandinista Nicaragua. Now, I said that they're not coming, but that got lost. So here's an example of how just covering a fake story, even saying that it's fake, actually helps promote it. So this is an example of how difficult and frustrating and challenging the job of journalism can be.
One of the themes I think Johan was talking about that stood out at the conference is that of millennials, talking about how millennials are voting differently than their predecessors. Millennials are having sort of a profound impact on democracy. And what do you think the role millennials play in contemporary politics is And why do you think it's important, if you think so?
I think the verdict, the jury is still out. Okay. I haven't seen it. I'm looking for some kind of a congealing of a voting bloc, not necessarily on the left or right, but as a rebellion against traditional American politics. What I'd like to see, because of my interest in world affairs, is some focus on what the United States is doing in the world. I mean, this is really affecting young people because all these wars everywhere are bankrupting us. Mm-hmm. We are paying hundreds of billions of dollars just to service our debt. And that's what's paying for all these foreign wars. And who's going to have to go out and fight in these wars? You know, in 2 years, there will be kids going to fight in Afghanistan who were not born when the war began. This is by far the longest war in American history. I'm hoping that young people would focus on some issue like that, which I don't see as ideological, mm-hmm. since the left-right spectrum has nothing to do with what you think about our intervention in foreign wars. And seizing on an issue like that could make themselves into a voting bloc. But that doesn't happen by itself. That's an organizing project. Mm-hmm. I think it's doable. I think the raw material is out there, just like I think there's a constituency out there in the American public for a more restrained and prudent foreign policy. But it has never had the political or intellectual leadership needed yet to congeal that group into a movement. And that's a great challenge for the millennials themselves, because nobody else can organize them. They have to do it themselves. Mm.
Do you think that the Obama coalition did not resent that sort of coming together in a way? Because that was one of the highest turnouts of millennials in sort of history.
It seemed to be at the time. Mm-hmm. And I remember reading stories saying that people don't change their voting patterns over life usually. So the way you vote the first or second mm-hmm. election, that's what you're going to vote the rest of your life. And this means the Republican Party is really going into decline and right. they're finished. So that didn't turn out
that
to be the truth.
Yeah.
Therefore, I conclude that this was not the sign of a growing force in American life, that it was a combination of a variety of factors, and that maybe people became too complacent and thought Obama is the model for the future now. You know, I also am a college professor and I'm around students all the time. One thing I noted after the Trump election, and at Brown University, we had just the shock that I'm sure you had here. We had students weeping on the streets and hugging each other and trying to figure out what was happening. Was that these kids had assimilated the view, which is logical from their lifetime, that American politics and history is more or less moving in the same direction. Sometimes it moves a little more slowly, there are some slight reverses, but everything is essentially getting better, and I can help it get better. So you don't really have to focus too much on that, because that's the way everything is going. I think this was the biggest shock of the Trump election. Everything that you had given to you, everything that you appreciated, that you liked, can be taken away from you. And I don't think this was something that the college-age generation of today recognized, because it doesn't reflect their own history. Mm-hmm. So maybe it's a wake-up call to mm-hmm. realize that even the modest kinds of democratic openings that we experienced in recent years are not permanent. There's no such thing as a permanent conquest. You always have to defend the territory that you've seized.
Mm-hmm. So from that, what do you think millennials and sort of current students should do now? Especially, I know Oberlin has sort of talked about as this bubble, probably even more so than Brown. Should we, you know, if we grew up on sort of Obama's hope, should we give up on that? Should we just become sort of nihilistic, or should we, you know, what can we do to fight that?
Well,
process?
I'm against nihilism as an approach to life.
That's clear. Thank you.
But I do think that it's important for young people to try to break out of their own environment. You know, we're all products of our background and our upbringing and our pasts. But you need to go beyond that. There's a lot of people out there that aren't like us, and they're not all deplorable. Mm-hmm. They have legitimate fears, and they have suffered because of what's happened in this country. And that's why they voted for Donald Trump, because he represented something in which they could find their own rage reflected. It was fake, but it was a good act. And I think it's important that young people also try to realize that you cannot preach to the converted. This is not the way to change this country or change the world. You have to open yourself up to other ideas so that you can penetrate other people's minds. It's difficult. I sometimes say this about travel. There's two ways to travel in the world. Either you can go to another country and be in it, or you can get into a little bubble, take your bubble on the plane, and then get off the bubble, and your bubble will be in another country, but you're actually not in that country at all because you're still in your bubble. There's an analogy for domestic politics, too. Mm-hmm. You can't think that your views are the only ones and condemn people who don't have them. The really difficult thing is to try to understand people who really have suffered as a result of what has happened in America over the last 20 or 30 years. And not all of those people are people of color. They're not all transgender. They're not all immigrants. They're not all Muslims. There's a lot of the kind of people that voted for Donald Trump who have really legitimate fury and rage at what has happened in this country. And they are the raw material for change. Mm. So let's try not to see them as hostiles and as enemies, but to try to see them as people from whom we can learn.
I would just add to that one sort of experience that opened my eyes a little bit was during, I think, October of 2016, I actually went canvassing for Hillary Clinton with the Oberlin College Democrats in the city of Lorain, which is about a 20-minute drive from here. And, you know, I didn't talk to any of the people whose doors I knocked on for maybe more than 2.5 minutes. And it still, you know, shattered the perception of how they thought. Because, you know, myself, like a lot of other people at the time, thought that Democrats were in a really good position. There was really not a lot to worry about. It was like, okay, I'm going to go just to make sure, but I think things are going to work out fine. And I met a lot of people who said things like, I just want something different, which personally, you know, I grew up outside the Beltway. My family talks about politics all the time. You know, I go to a place like Oberlin. That's not really my mindset. I don't think in that way. But it hadn't occurred to me that there was a substantive population of, you know, swing state voters who thought that way. And I realized that sort of in that moment, probably much too late.
Yeah. So did this lead you to suspect that Trump might win or to be a little less shocked than the rest of us?
I had a bad feeling.
Read in my New York Times on the day before the election that there was a 92% chance of Hillary Clinton getting elected. They should have called you.
Yeah. Mm. I, much like probably everyone at this school, was looking at 538 every day for weeks before.
Reloading the link hourly. Yeah.
Exactly. And I think the day before the election, I saw that the odds that they had given Trump were like 34%. And that was when I really sort of knew that things were going to go very poorly. Because in my mind, I was like, listen, Hillary Clinton may be a terrible candidate. She may have terrible timing. She may be extremely unpopular. But compared to Donald Trump, if his odds are 34%, something is not going to go right here. And you know, November 8th, we all woke up and it was a very somber scene.
No path to 270. Remember that? 270 was the number of electoral votes you needed. They kept saying this about Donald Trump. He has no path to 270. Well, they didn't knock on the doors you knocked
There's
on.
Always a path. Yeah. There's always a path.
I unfortunately, now that sort of the election has unfolded, I think I'd like to transition a little more to sort of foreign policy and how foreign policy has really been upset by the new Trump administration. Clearly, you talked about sort of in the past, American foreign policy has been far from perfect. But sort of what do you see now that we have a new president, a new administration that's really sort of breaking a whole lot of norms? How is that impacting the global scene?
The best thing I found in Donald Trump during the campaign was his promise to subvert some basic principles of American foreign policy, which I happen to think should be subverted. So, for example, Donald Trump said he wanted to reduce America's role in NATO and let Europe run NATO. I think this is a great idea. But the American security establishment hates this idea. The reason is we pay all the bills for NATO, and as a result, we get to decide what NATO's security policy is. And the policy we want is confront Russia, be right in their nose, be right on their face, have maneuvers right on their borders, provoke them, make them know that we're right there. A lot of countries in Europe don't want to do that. They'd like to reduce tensions. They'd like to accommodate Russian security interests. But they are getting all the money from America, so they do what America says. We insist on continuing that project because we don't want a more accommodating policy toward Russia. So I thought the Trump idea of letting Europe decide European security is great. Then he decides he doesn't want to do that. I also read a tweet from Donald Trump saying, we have to get out of Afghanistan now. It's insane. Then what happens? He gets elected and he gave this speech. You could tell he really didn't want to say this, but the words were put in front of him. And he's announcing more troops going to Afghanistan. These kinds of things impress me over and over again with the power of the force that brings everyone in Washington into this foreign policy consensus that tells us we have to be involved everywhere and we've got to have our military everywhere. Don't forget, Bill Clinton campaigned by saying it was the economy, stupid. And then George W. Bush said we would have a humble foreign policy. And Donald Trump said our foreign policy was a total disaster. So this is great. But when they get into office, they're drinking the Beltway Kool-Aid. So I would like to see us try to break away from that. And this was my great disappointment with Trump. So I'm all for blowing up some of these hoary old principles of American foreign policy. I don't think the United States needs to have a fleet patrolling the Persian Gulf. We had to do that to keep the Soviet Union out and to protect our oil supplies. Now there's no Soviet Union. We don't get our oil supplies from there anymore. We're only protecting the Persian Gulf so China can get its oil securely and Uncle Sucker pays the bill. So I like the idea of undermining some foreign policy principles that we've been following for years. But first of all, Trump hasn't done this. In many ways, he's been sucked right in. In some ways, I feel like Hillary Clinton is president. It's like a transgender version. We just got the foreign policy that Clinton was promising us. And in the areas where Trump is changing foreign policy, he's doing it in such a bizarre, one-shot, unplanned, scatterbrained way that even changes that he makes are terrifying everybody because you don't know what he's going to say when he wakes up the next morning. So I would love to see him replace a couple of the generals around him with diplomats who have some longer-term views, and maybe some people who would remind him of what he said during his campaign. But this is very difficult because once you're in Washington, you really do, as I said, get sucked into this consensus that tells you the United States has to be everywhere. Otherwise, we die.
Mm-hmm. Is there any way sort of to avoid that you see, or is it sort of the with Donald Trump sort of being this isolationist candidate and then completely going back on his word, does that mean that there's no chance of sort of American foreign policy changing?
I do think there's a constituency out there for a more prudent and restrained foreign policy, although it's very diffuse. So how do you reach people? You can't reach people with very long, involved messages about America's role in the world and what's happening in the Middle East and the Far East. That's too much. How do we focus it down? And actually, this conference gave me an idea. So I was supposed to speak about American militarism, and another person was on the panel with me who has been the president of the Carnegie Endowment and worked in the U.S. government and so forth. So she was much more supportive of traditional American foreign policy, although critical of overemphasis on the military. I was in a different place, much more critical. However, she did, after I sat down, say that there's one thing I said she really agreed with, which was, it's time for us to get out of Afghanistan. So I'm thinking, here's a place where we're both agreeing. This is a person from the heart of the foreign policy establishment, and I'm one of these outsiders. So one thing we agree on is, we got to get out of Afghanistan. It's too long. We're never going to win. Even the people waging the war have admitted that it's not about victory. It's just about staying there until the Taliban realize that we're never going to leave, and then they're going to have to negotiate, which is an absolute fantasy. So this leads me to conclude, or to ask myself, could that be the reduced bumper sticker size slogan? I grew up in the period, support our troops in Vietnam, bring them home. How about support our boys in Afghanistan, bring them home. Mm-hmm. 16 years is enough. Or some slogan like that.
Yeah.
I think that, forget about attacking the entire structure of how we approach the world and the military budget. That's complicated. The first step could be building a coalition around, we got to get out of Afghanistan, and ask every candidate for Congress and every presidential candidate, are you going to pull our troops out of Afghanistan? Mm-hmm. Otherwise, if you say, no, I'm leaving. I'm not supporting you. That would be possibly an issue where I think you could reach the hearts and minds of many Americans. Mm-hmm. So if we're looking for one foreign policy issue for the next election cycle and into 2020 presidential elections, I'm just thinking, as a result of my appearance at this conference, that might be the one.
I'm curious. You talked sort of, one of your specialties is thinking about American militarization, right? And I think Trump has sort of been a very intriguing figure sort of on that topic. In one sense, he sort of undermined, you know, the CIA and other intelligence agencies that historically, you know, like in Nicaragua had sort of all this covert power. But on the other hand, he really relies on a lot of generals for his you know, personal staff, like John Kelly, you know, his chief of staff, things like that. So what do you make of Trump's relationship with the military?
I don't like it. I think it's too reductive. I don't mind having a general in the room, but I don't think everybody in the room should be a general.
Good caveat, yeah.
Like I said earlier, we're all products of our environment. These people are not only products of the military, but all the generals around Trump come from Central Command. They've all been the Iraq, Afghanistan, Iran, Syria. That's their whole life. We got to get out of that. We shouldn't even be in that part of the world. Whereas they are thinking very deep about how we're going to make sure that northern Syria does not fall under the control of some group we don't like, and not too many cabinet members from one group get into the Lebanese government. This shouldn't be any of our business. So I do think that the Middle East is an example of a place where I think many Americans realize we're in too deep. You know, there was a great correspondent covering Vietnam for the New Yorker named Robert Chaplin, and he came up with a principle that I think we could probably revive now. He said, if Americans ever get to know when is the rainy season in some foreign country, it means we're too deeply involved. And I think we're getting to know too much about these countries, and it's never good for us.
Speaking of sort of American involvement in foreign countries, one of your sort of specialties is also Latin America. Could you talk about maybe, especially in the contemporary political climate where Latin America is not necessarily the first thing on everyone's minds, how the new U.S. foreign policy, or perhaps old U.S. foreign policy that has been carried on by President Trump, is affecting that region?
I'm going to talk about two countries in particular where I think there's been a big change, and that is Mexico and Cuba. Before going into those particular situations, though, I think it's clear that Trump has turned over his Latin America policy effectively to Senator Rubio. Marco Rubio is telling him what to do in Latin America. He doesn't really have someone in the State Department who's a Latin America person. Rubio, of course, comes out of the Cuban exile community, and he's the one who pushed Trump, I think, to crack down on Cuba and break some of the new relationships that President Obama was trying to build. But as one who has been to Cuba a number of times and was just there last year, I can tell you that the Trump policies are producing the exact opposite of what he says they're producing. So he says he wants to hurt the Cuban government and not allow the regime to profit from Americans. And he wants to find a way to support private enterprise so that they'll break away from the tyrannical control of the state. So when I was there less than a year ago, I was with a group of student journalists, and they were all covering stories. One of them was covering the story about Airbnb. Mm-hmm. Airbnb has a couple of thousand properties. People are fixing up their houses. It means they employ people to paint the houses. They need to bring the furniture in from Miami. They're making money for themselves in hard currency. Then some of them are able to start their own little shops and so forth. So now you can't do that anymore. It's not legal for individual Americans to go. You can only go if you're on a tour. The tours are all run by the government. They show you what they want to show you. Up until the time Trump came in, Americans could go to Cuba and walk around and talk to anyone they wanted and see what they wanted. Now, that's not possible anymore. So you're undermining private enterprise in Cuba and supporting the government by pouring more money into its coffers while sealing Americans off from the reality of Cuba and exposing them only to what the government wants to tell them. So this is the exact opposite of what even Trump said he wanted to achieve. Mm-hmm. This shows you how poorly thought out these policies are. And I can tell you, it's causing confusion and even despair in Cuba from people who really thought America was going to help them pull out of the situation they're in. Mexico is a different situation. Mexico, we have to understand, don't forget, we seized a third of Mexico in a war. We forgot that, but don't think the Mexicans forgot it. And the Mexican political system has been very successful over generations at managing and tamping down natural Mexican nationalism. And Mexican nationalism, by definition, is always anti-American, naturally. Now, with Trump attacking Mexico and threatening to build the wall, and saying he wants to cut off NAFTA and he's not going to listen to Mexicans anymore and they're all rapists, what's happening in Mexico is something that I always suspected might one day happen, and that is that the political elite can no longer suppress anti-Americanism. And we are now seeing the polls in Mexico showing a leftist anti-American candidate as the leading prospect for president of Mexico. If we ever get a president in Mexico who really represents the nationalism of Mexicans, that's going to be a sea change. And let me tell you something. Mexico is one of the two or three most important countries in the world to us. We don't even put it in the top 50. But countries that are right next to you are really important. Upheaval in Mexico, hostility in Mexico, friendship between Mexico and our international rivals are big long-term problems for us. And we are pouring gasoline onto the fire of Mexican nationalism, and that fire can come back and consume us in very serious ways.
I want to continue with that. Sort of, there's been this whole NAFTA renegotiation is going on right now, and Trump has sort of threatened to completely do away with NAFTA and sort of revert back to WTO era, you know, rulings, tariffs, things like that. Do you see the prospect of like a trade war between Mexico and the US happening, or how does NAFTA figure into the conversation?
I do think that there's a prospect for economic confrontation between Mexico and the United States. It's not going to be pretty. One of the problems is that so many of these goods that cross the border in both directions are manufactured in both places. How do you separate them? It's a little minor league version of our problem with China. If we cut off relations with China, where are we going to get our iPhones? It's too late for that. So I do see a prospect for confrontation with Mexico. And I actually think that there's a large part of the Mexican population that's frustrated enough to be willing to embrace that. As I said, nationalism has always been bubbling up under the surface in Mexico. People like Pancho Villa and Zapata are still big heroes in Mexico. And I think we're treading on real thin ice when we are tempting Mexico to do whatever you want. We don't care. It's not good for any big power to have an unfriendly country on its borders. That's just geopolitics 101. We've never had to think about that. It's one reason the United States is doesn't get along well. We don't play well with others. If you're living in Europe, you always have to think about the country over here, the country over there, and you've been thinking like that for centuries. So you're used to taking into consideration the possibilities of how everyone around you is going to react. We've never had to think like that. All we have is the quiet Mexicans and the stolid Canadians and declining fish stocks. That's our entire environment. And we're so used to that, I think we could be in for a big shock. If I think the NAFTA piece could be managed in a way that might be satisfactory to both sides, but I'm not seeing the desire to do that. NAFTA also is still controversial in Mexico, and I can easily imagine if this leading candidate in Mexico is elected, if President Trump were to threaten him with any kind of sanctions, he would say, fine, bring them on. We do the same thing. We don't protest. Do whatever you want to us. Hey, we're Latin America. You've been beating on us for 100 years, and we can take it. And not only that, we're going to start calling up people that don't like you in the world. What would you think about having a Chinese aircraft carrier docking at one of the Mexican ports or a little Russian maneuver in Mexico? Well, this is unthinkable to us now. But why should it be? We got to be thinking several moves ahead here. Otherwise, we're going to find ourselves in real problems with our neighbors to the south.
Do you think, sort of going on that theme, it seems like a lot of Trump's foreign policy so far has been unthinking. You know, you said like he's drunk the Kool-Aid and isn't necessarily considering all these global factors. To add to that, even in Foggy Bottom, you've got Secretary of State Tillerson, who is sort of shaky right now, and you know, the State Department is understaffed, things like that. Do you see American foreign policy becoming like a serious issue that there's, you know, within the remaining 3 years of the Trump administration, that there's going to be some serious issues?
I'm very distressed to see the hollowing out of the State Department. I mean, mm-hmm. It's crazy to realize we're in a conflict now, potentially very serious, with North Korea. So we don't have a U.S. ambassador to South Korea. We haven't gotten one. We don't have an assistant secretary of state for Asia. You know, I've watched diplomats at work, and I've come to have great admiration for the skill of diplomacy. You need to be in constant contact with people in other governments so that you know what they're thinking and what they want and what you can do for them. And we're not in touch anymore. So I think it was in The Godfather that the line said, you got to keep your friends close and your enemies closer. You got to be in touch with people all the time. That's what diplomats do. Diplomacy is all about advancing the interests of your own country. It's not about friendship or being nice or morality or any of that. It's about national interest. And if we don't have diplomats who are experienced in this profession, and this is a profession that really does take experience, we lose the ability to promote the same national interest that Trump says he's totally focused on. I'd love to see, instead of all those generals around him, a couple of career diplomats who have served in different parts of the world and understand how other people think.
Yeah, too bad he cleared them all out. One other question about Latin America. Venezuela's been in the news a lot recently, and in August, Trump, you know, made this incendiary remark that maybe we should go in and invade them. Did you have thoughts about that, and maybe sort of how that plays into American, the American perspective on the rest of Latin America?
That was really a bizarre moment. Venezuela is in a state of terrible collapse, which I think is most unfortunate, but if I were president of the United States, I would think, well, there's Venezuela, there's South America, there's countries. It's not up to us to go in with our 1,000-mile-long screwdriver and try to fix Venezuela. A suggestion by Trump that we got to fix it and maybe we would invade with American troops not only shows a failure to understand what's happening in Venezuela, because what would American troops do there? You'd have to think that all through. But it ignores the fact that all over Latin America, if there's one thing people share, it's an intense historical memory of the Marines landing on the shores of one country after another. Even people who've come to love America, new generations, all know about this history. So the mere mention that at this moment in 2017, the United States is talking about landing troops on the beaches or parachuting out of the sky in some Latin American country is going to infuriate not just Venezuelans and not just leftists, but all patriots throughout Latin America. And that was just a one-day tweet. It might have thought he thought of it in 5 minutes. He wrote it another 5 minutes. Maybe he forgot it 5 minutes later. But that tweet is going to resonate in Latin America as long as Trump is in office and beyond.
I think we're almost out of time, but I want to sort of go as sort of broad strokes as we can, maybe. One of the things you've talked about, both in terms of Latin America policy and other things, is that a lot of President Trump's decisions, and in fact, a lot of the current political decisions that are happening, you know, regardless of which politician you're talking about, are stemming from either ignorance, deliberate misinformation, or just not knowing what's going on. And you can see that in sort of in terms of the rise of fake news. Briefly, what do you think the rise of fake news means for our political future, and maybe how do we avoid the implications of that as bad as they are?
Part of what I think we need to realize is that just because things are written that are critical of American life, we don't want to dismiss them all of a sudden as being fake. I think this is actually part of the reason why the United States now wants to force Russia TV to register as a foreign agent. It's because Russia TV is out there covering the seamy side of American life. It's not because they're promoting Russia. It's that they're showing things about America that we don't want shown. I do think that the fake news phenomenon is a real problem, and I do think interference in elections is a real problem. Unfortunately, the United States is not in a very good position to be pointing a finger. I mean, we have intervened in more elections than all other countries in the world combined. In fact, I've thought about it as a book. All the times the U.S. has interfered in foreign elections, the only problem is the book would be just too long. Fake news is also something that we've been very familiar with and used as a tactic for many years. I mean, I wrote a book about how we overthrew the government of Iran in 1953. And at that time, CIA was paying newspapers in Iran to write that the prime minister was a homosexual, a Jew, a British agent, everything that they could think of about him. And it worked. So we have used this in many cases. That doesn't excuse other people from doing it at a time when it's a much more sophisticated environment. For me, the antidote to fake news is real news. But we're getting less and less of that. I think even established media outlets in some cases are just throwing up their hands and saying, well, let's just get down into the mud and join the fray. So I don't think you want to conflate real news, honest news, with news that supports our political system and our political leaders. There's a danger when we start saying, these people are too critical. They're too crazy. They're trying to propose a wacko ideas, so that's got to be fake. It's a difficult and a new road we're on, particularly with algorithms and the internet. But our political system should be resilient enough to survive that. My biggest concern, frankly, is that people are so poorly educated in America now. I actually sometimes think I should stop lamenting about how members of Congress don't realize they should be funding education more. And I'm starting to think they shouldn't. They realize. Don't make people smart. If you make people too smart, if you start to put lots of money into elementary schools so that everybody in America really knows what's going on in the world, and our math scores get to be as high as Estonia's, for example, it's not good for people in power. So education, for me, is a great combatant in this fight. And actually, I think of myself as an educator in a way. I am a teacher in school, but I'm also trying to educate Americans about who we are, what we've done, and why other people in the world see us the way we do. Just because that kind of news is off the paradigm doesn't make it fake. And that's what bothers me a little bit about the obsession with trying to counter fake news, because I think in some ways that's a cover for saying we got to watch out for news that's too critical.
Yeah, well, thank you so very much. It looks like we've run out of time. Thank you, Daniel, for joining me.
Thanks for having me, as always.
And Professor Kinzer, thank you so much. It was an absolute pleasure to speak with you. And I should also say, you mentioned the importance of education. Thank you for your work. Thank you for educating Daniel and I and anyone else who's listening. It was an absolute pleasure.
Look forward to being back in Oberlin someday.
I hope you come back.
Great.
You've been listening to The Weekly, a co-production of WOBC and the Oberlin Review. I'm your host, Johan Cavert. Thanks for listening.